This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 14th.
Good morning. So I have to go to a master's defense right at 11 o'clock today, so we're going to try to end a couple minutes early so I have time to get there. The plan for today is to finish talking about the Donahue and Calvert material on socket programming, and then to talk about the assignment, and finish talking about the Donahue and Calvert material, to do some additional stuff on the get adder info library call for looking up hosts and information, which will be handy for doing the assignment, and then talk about the assignment. And if we have time, we'll go back to talking about DNS, which I realized I didn't finish. But before we begin, are there questions about anything at all? I think we're headed toward an exam in a couple of weeks, as I recall. We'll see that on the calendar here. Exam 2 weeks from Friday, just for planning purposes.
And are those exams going to be similar to the written homework kind of style?
Yeah, generally speaking, that's the kind of thing. Some calculations, definitely some sort of knowledge-y things as opposed to analysis things. Well, yeah. So, back to talking about how this programming actually works. So remember last time we had talked both about what the server does and what the client does, and we had got to the point of talking about they communicate, and we're going to have more to say about that today, how that goes, what goes into the details of protocol, and finally close the connection with the usual close function that you're familiar with. Okay, so given that the client is the active entity in this story, it's clear that the client has to know the server's IP address and port number. If it doesn't know that, then it's not going to be able to find the server and make the connection. And it's the connect call where it uses that information. The server, on the other hand, if you think about the sort of socket, bind, listen, accept story, the server really only ever deals with an IP address that just contains its own port number. That's the only one that it has to manipulate. So and that occurs where? Which system call? This is the kind of knowledge that I want you to to develop about this stuff when it comes to, when we're talking about knowledge questions on exams. So where does the server code talk about its own port number? In which system call?
Bind? Port number?
It's port number in bind. That's right. In the bind system call, it passes a sock adder data structure to bind that contains the port number that it wants to use. Okay. The next thing to know about this is now we're moving into the communicate phase where they're doing the send and receive operations. And they've sort of abbreviated this on the slide to a higher level picture without all the extra arguments. You know, normally you'd pass the address of the string, the length of the string, and the extra flags as well as the socket descriptor. But just conceptually, you want to send using TCP. So the client, or whoever, does a send operation, what comes back as a result of that? What's the return value from the send operation? So you would normally write, you would assign the return value of this operation to a variable, right? So what is the meaning of the value that's returned?
Isn't it how many bytes were sent?
The number of bytes sent. Or minus one if an error occurred. Similarly, the receive operation actually returns bytes received. And fills in a pointer, or fills in a buffer with the stuff that was actually received. So here there are two things to know about this. First of all, with TCP, this is not true of UDP, but with TCP, what you send as far as the boundaries of things is not the same thing that the receiver necessarily sees. So in this case, the client sent the string "Hello, Bob." The receiver did a receive operation and received "Hello." And then subsequently, a subsequent receive operation received "Bob." There's a little bit of a lie here in that these are not, you have to forget about "not." This is just an illustration, so don't be too literal about this. You have to think of these as not being null terminated strings, but just exactly what it said. So, this is what I'm trying to get at, is that just because you sent something as one chunk doesn't mean that you receive it as the same chunk. The network and the operating system are allowed to chop up these streams. Remember, TCP is a stream protocol, so it's allowed to chop up the stream any old way it wants to do, including returning one character at a time, or merging multiple messages together like you see here. That's all fair game in a TCP world. Well, this is a pain in the you-know-what.
It would be received in order.
They will be received in order. Right. You will receive the characters in the order HELLO(BOB).
Okay.
But where the boundaries are may vary. Okay? So why is this a pain in the you-know-what? Well, the poor programmer who's writing this code has to sort of be aware that when you do a receive operation within a protocol, you may not get everything that you expected. And so the protocol itself, the definition of what the data is supposed to be, has to tell you where the boundaries are, because the send and receive operations don't. It actually gets worse than this. It's clear here that if you're attempting to receive something that you're expecting to say "Hello, Bob," you've got to put the receive operation in a loop, right? And then look at what you get, and when you get to "Hello, Bob," then you can stop. And you have to remember what you've already got, because that may be part of the next thing that the client is going to say. So the receive has to go in the loop. It's worse in that the send also has to go in the loop, because when you do a send operation, there's no promise that it will actually send everything that you said to send. You're guaranteed that it will send at least one character. So you can put this in a loop and not have it sort of sit there spinning, doing nothing useful. But the send also has to go in a loop, because it may return 1, which would correspond to sending the H, and then you have to adjust the pointers, right? Because the pointers and the length, because the next thing you want to send is the E. So now we have to do another send call, this time pointing at the E with a shorter length, okay? So all of this is stuff you have to cope with in your project. And what's even worse about all this is that you can write code that ignores everything that I've just been saying for the last 10 minutes about it not sending, possibly sending everything, and not possibly receiving any everything. And in at least small examples and small systems, it's probably going to work fine. But it's still wrong. Okay? And if you develop the habit of writing code that assumes that send sends everything and that receive receives everything that was sent, you will be building broken systems that will come back and bite you. I guarantee it. Why can I guarantee this? Because I've done it. Absolutely. Okay. See, now these guys don't even put the sends in loops either. They haven't been bitten by that one. But you look specification, it says doesn't have to send everything. Okay.
What actually causes it not to send everything?
What causes it not to send everything is full buffers. In the operating system, it's really not a TCP thing specifically. It's a operating system thing. Close the connection. Well, again, this should have those in loops. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the messages that we're going to send as part of this. First of all, remember, when sending strings, Sterlen does not give you, we talked about this last time, Sterlen does not give you the right answer for how much you have to send if you're sending a null terminated string. So don't forget that. And just as a refresher, as far as TCP is concerned, it's just a stream of bytes. It knows nothing about what they mean. And the boundaries mean nothing. So it's up to the application protocol to put data in the stream that the other guy can figure out what it means. So strings. Two choices, and in the assignment I'm going to have you do it both ways. Two choices by two choices, I guess. What this picture means is that you can choose between ASCII coding, which is 1 byte per character, and a Unicode or UTF encoding, which involves multiple bytes per character. Has anybody ever talked with you about internationalization of code? A little bit. Where?
Well, I guess maybe it's not the same thing. Because the only thing that I've dealt with is regionalizing. Or is that what it's called? When you create, basically in C Sharp, it lets you have like sort of that hash table where you can assign, you have a key and then you can have
different messages for different languages. Yes. That's one part of it. The other part of it is think about all the languages of the world that don't use the same alphabet that we do, right? Turns out that there are thousands and thousands of different characters in all of those alphabets, and you can't represent them within an 8-bit character, which is only 256 or 128 in the case of basic ASCII. So Unicode and UTF are UTF is within Unicode, is a way to represent character strings with multiple bytes per character. Okay? So you may, in a protocol, have to deal with UTF strings, not just simple ASCII character strings. And if you do that, then each character is going to take up multiple bytes, as in the upper picture. And or if you do it using ASCII, it might be one byte per character. Okay, so that's one choice that's going to occur for strings. The other choice is, are we going to say where the end of the string is by passing, well, in this case, a new line character as a terminator? Remember, in HTTP and the mail protocols, it was carriage return and line feed to delimit the ends of lines, and an extra blank line to determine the end of a certain kind of input. All right. But you can also use, as part of the protocol decision, you could decide to use a null character here to indicate the end of the string. Okay, or you can say, this is kind of a cross product of things, right? We have what kind of characters are we sending and how are we delimiting them. You could say, I'm going to send the length of the string as the first thing that I send, and then the receiver will just count the bytes. Can be either way. So think about it this way. Which one is easier for the receiver to deal with?
The length.
I think so. Because in this scheme, it has to figure out where the end is. And in this scheme, it's told where the end is before it starts. Okay, suppose we want to send a number value. Again, we have some choices. We could send a number as a string of characters. You know, digits, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, which is what this is doing here. So that's how it's going to work in a protocol like HTTP, right? When we looked at the HTTP output and, you know, the protocol version number was 1.1, that was the character 1, the character point, and the character 1 again. But maybe in some other kind of protocol, what we're really interested in is thinking of that as a numerical value, and we could send numbers like they're encoded in machines. So this picture shows encoding as done with characters, right? And so it's kind of obvious that the advantage is that if you open up the packet with Wireshark or something, you'll be able to see what the number is. And it's also obvious that you can send numbers of arbitrary size without any problem. But it's not a very good use of space, for one thing. So how many bits does it take to represent a decimal digit? Not as a character, but just as a if you were representing it as a numerical value. How many bits does it take? No, just one decimal digit. What?
You're talking about.
I want to represent values from 0 to 9.
Okay, so you need a byte for each one of those as a character, right?
As a character, I do, but what if I just want to represent it as a number?
Oh, well, it depends on what type of. I'm talking about decimal, so you mean like float type? Or
no, I have 9 different values, and I need to be able to distinguish between them. What, or 10 different values, sorry. 3 bits would get me 8, but I have 10.
Oh.
Okay? So it takes, right, with 3 bits I can represent 8 different values. So with about 3.3 bits I can represent 10 different, well, what do you mean by 3 point, what's a 0.3 of a bit? Well, if I have a bunch of decimal digits I can sort of amortize those 0.3s over all of them. So, okay? So let's check that understanding. So in a 16-bit number, right, you divide that by 3.3 and you get what? 4? 12? 4? 4 point something, right? So, how big a value can you, how big now a decimal value can you represent in 16 bits? This is a number you should know. Brooke? No. What's the biggest decimal value that fits in 16 bits? 2 to the 16 minus 1, which is? You're close. It is 6. It goes by the name 64K, and the actual decimal value of that is 65,535, right? You've heard that number before. 2 to the 16th minus 1 is 65,535. So it isn't 3.2, 3. Okay. Yeah, all right. So when we divided 16 by 3.3, we got 4.2 or 4.3 or something. And notice that 65,535 is 5 decimal digits, but to really represent everything you could represent in 5 decimal digits, you'd have to go up to 99,999. So, yeah, our guess is about right. It's 3.3 bits per decimal digit. Right? Anyway, so now look at this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 decimal digits times 8, when I encode it as characters, is 256 bits. Right? But when I encode it as a binary string, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 by, no, not 256. 7 times 8 is 56 bits. Jeez. if I encode it as a binary string with 3.3 bits per digit, then it would be 24 bits. So we're wasting a lot of space in sending things that way. And before I can actually use computer instructions to manipulate it as a number, I have to convert it back to the decimal form. So when you're sending numbers that really need to be interpreted as numbers, maybe it's better to send things in a binary form. Okay. So, in computer memory, here's a computer memory. Here's address 0, and here's address N. Suppose I want to write down a number that uses 4 bytes. Right, so we'll write some hex now for these. I guess they're going to use decimal, right? So, this is wrong. Sorry about that. You have a choice about which way you lay out these bytes within memory. And the choices are, you know, you start with this one at the low address, and you go from there upward. And so, you know, this could be either 009246, or it could be 2469200. That's an arbitrary choice that the machine designer gets to make. Or in the case of the MIPS architecture, at least, the programmer gets to make whether you're using big or little endian representation. So big endian means that the high order byte of a number comes first in storage or transmission. So the high order byte is the big end of the number, and big endian means it comes first. Little endian, the opposite. The low order byte comes first. Okay, so I think we did this once before. The Intel machines that you're familiar with are little endian machines. They put the, and this is partly why I find it so difficult to read dumps of memory on those machines, is because it's backwards. From what you expect from your usual experience of reading numbers, the high order part is on the right. Does anybody know where the names big and little endian come from? What? No. Anybody else? This is actually a literature question, of all things. This comes from these debates were raging, okay, in the 1970s. People were at each other's throats about which way you should do this, and somebody identified this as a big endian or little endian problem, and the reference is to Gulliver's Travels, where you've heard of Gulliver's Travels, I hope, where one part of a population insists that the right way to eat eggs is by eating the big end first, and the other population insists you should eat the little end first. And they go at each other tooth and nail about this question, just like the protocol designers were doing at that time about how to send data. Well, in the internet, big endian won. You send the high order part first.
So this is the higher address on the left.
The lower address on the left. Right? The way you would see my picture here of memory. Okay, so the lower address is there. Yeah, Matt.
Why did they decide big endian was the one that was the regular way and little endian is so bad?
Because the big endians won.
Oh.
You know, it's kind of an arbitrary decision, isn't it?
I just wasn't sure if there's like some subtlety.
Well, there are arguments in favor of both, right? The big Endian picture is, in some sense, more in line with the way we write numbers normally, right? The first thing more in line with the way we write numbers and the way we write dumps, right? So when you look at something in a dump, it looks like a big Endian number. That's a good thing. The little Endian story is a little more subtle. It says that, as I'm running through something and putting it together to make a message out of it, as I'm running through this memory, I'm going to encounter the low order thing first, and so it makes sense to send in the little endian order.
When we're sending bytes, we're sending from the low address, right, and then size, or what order is actually sent in bytes? Is it low or higher?
It's sent in memory order.
Okay.
It's sent in memory order. So the first thing to go down the wire is this thing, whatever it is.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So the problem being that from the point of view of sending data, we really think of it as sending it from memory, and so we send it in memory order, whatever that is.
But we start at the low end of memory.
We start at the low end of memory and work upwards. Yeah. Which, if you store your bytes in big endian order in memory, means that you send them big endian on the wire. Okay, but now we have to worry about big endian machines talking to little endian machines, and so we have to come to an agreement about what we're going to send on the wire, and they decided on big endian. And there's actually a fairly famous essay about this issue, Beyond Gulliver's Travels, that you can probably find on the internet about, you know, what the battles were and how things resolved themselves. All right. If you have multiple fields, you can paste them together in sort of obvious ways. The whole trick is that basically you have to build a structure in memory that is what you want to send, and then send those bytes. I mean, that's I think the easiest way to look at this is rather than worrying too much about what's on the wire, think about what the representation in memory is going to be, and then send the bytes. Order. The thing that you have to watch out for when programming in C is using structs in C can mislead you about the size of what the representation in memory is going to be, and therefore the size of the message that you're going to send and what's going to be in it. So in C there are fairly complicated rules about how things get think how data in structures gets laid out in memory, but in particular, it's designed so that ints, that's the most important one, always get stored on 4-byte boundaries, because that's the faster thing to work with on a computer. The memory system works much better if 4-byte things are stored on 4-byte boundaries. That is, the low order 2 bits of the address are 0. And some machines can't even cope with things that aren't aligned. So if you have a struct that looks like this, that starts with a short, which is 16 bits, 2 bytes, it will lay it out with the 2 bytes and then a padding field, or maybe vice versa, right? It isn't always clear that it's going to, exactly what it's going to do.
That would depend on the Indianness then?
That would perhaps depend on the Indianness, yeah. It definitely depends on the compiler, the decision that it makes. So, what you want to, the process of turning something like this into an actual sequence of bytes to send over the wire is called serialization, and the usual thing to do is to explicitly control the process of turning a struct in memory like that looks like this into a sequence of bytes to be sent over the wire, and not rely on the compiler to do it. So you wouldn't pass to the send system call adder of this struct and size of this struct. Rather, you would copy the members into a sequential byte buffer and then send that, or send the individual members separately, which can be kind of expensive. Okay. Time-ish. Yes. So let's talk about the assignment. Didn't I do that? I did that already. All right. Well, this is kind of the story for this assignment is kind of silly, but the things to be done are interesting enough that it's worth doing. So the idea is that you're going to write a client and a server. They are C programs, not C Sharp or Python or Java or anything. Sorry. You got to wrestle with these harder issues at least once. And you're going to write both sides of it. Start with the Echo server code from Donahue and Calvert. That's an okay starting point. The client takes 2 command line arguments because the client, why 2 command line arguments?
The server and
the server name or IP address and the port number, right? The server, on the other hand, needs to take just 1 command line argument to say what port number it should use. Use port numbers. Ooh, can't do that, huh? Okay. Use port numbers bigger than 1024. Don't try to use lower ones. They're reserved to use by root, at least on Unix systems. A very silly security step that really does nothing at all.
But do you not really care whether we do this on the Windows side or the Linux side?
I really don't care. Well, I can give you more help with the Unix side. So that's so maybe you care, but all right. Start the server first. It should be a program that keeps running through thick and thin until you kill it with a signal, or kill it from the task manager or something. Shouldn't be anything you can send to it that makes it die. right? This is one of the characteristics of network programming, is that you have very little control over what will be sent to a program. It has to be prepared to deal with just about anything. It doesn't have to necessarily do anything useful when given just about anything, but it shouldn't die. If you can make it die, that's called a denial of service attack on that server. Okay, you start the server. The client connects to the server, and the first thing that happens is that the server sends to the client, once the client has connected, a welcome message. And we're going to use a null terminated string for that. Remember my warning about Sterlin. Okay. After receiving the welcome message from the server, now remember, again, you have to receive in a loop to make sure you get everything. Even though if you only put one, it's going to work. It's going to appear to work. But the right way is to put it in a loop. So, you receive that welcome message. The client prompts the user to enter an 8-digit personal ID number and product name as separate strings. Prompt first for one and then the other. And this, what is this? This is just, you know, printf and readlin? Is that what it is? What? Get printf and gets, or however you want to do that, whatever library you have for that, and send those to the servers, null terminated strings. The server has to read those and look them up in a table. And what I suggest here is you just build this table of arbitrary strings and user IDs and stuff into your program. Don't put it in a file or anything. I don't care about that. Right? Just make a structure that contains them. And sends back it worked or it didn't. Again, as a null terminated string. It's willing to do that a few times if you don't get it right. If it doesn't work, you close the connection, and the client should notice that and also give up. All right. At this point, we're going to, just for perversity, switch to sending the strings as a length followed by the string, just so you have an experience of doing it both ways, instead of being null terminated. Sterlin is now the appropriate thing. Don't forget the H to NS call on that value when passing it to, when putting it into the buffer to be sent, because it's supposed to be in network byte order. And then it looks it up in another table in the server and sends back yes or no, and I guess we're going to use null terminated strings for that.
For a big binary machine, when it converts to network byte order, it actually doesn't do anything.
It's a no op, yeah. Yeah. And again, we'll allow multiple tries to get this to work. Yes?
So you look up the product as well? Like, because you set a prompt for the ID and product?
Yeah.
Name.
Yeah.
So does it match the ID and then the product, or is that all like one?
It's two different things.
Okay.
Two different strings.
So
two different stables.
Different
what?
One ID number could have different products, or?
No.
I just don't understand what the. Like,
what's the distinction there?
Are you the password? So, like, what's
password,
the
ID, and product name are all three separate things that are all linked together as in, like, a record.
Right, yeah. So given. The data representation could allow the same product ID and different product name, but you don't have to do that. But they are separate strings.
Okay.
They're sent as separate strings.
Okay.
Okay?
And the second product thing we're sending with the password, don't we send the ID and then the name, and then also on the second thing we send, is it the name and password we send? Or is it already
I don't remember. Look up the pair of them. If authenticated after receiving the approval message, you send a password.
You can check the password with
the receive pair of ID and password.
So the ID refers to the PIN and the password. Make sure those are still valid.
Yeah. I'm much more concerned about what's being passed than what it actually does with it. Okay. That's what I'm really looking for, did you do the network piece of this rather than the... Because it's a stupid sort of thing to do anyway. But it does require you to pass numbers and strings and multiple things and try multiple times and pay attention to what happens when the other end closes the connection and all that stuff. Okay. So, don't worry too much about the IDs and passwords and all that. I just make up some data structures and do the appropriate thing. Okay? Well, we didn't get to finishing DNS today, so we will next time, and then we'll move on to the next thing on the list. I think is network layer. No, transport layer. Transport layer.
So you're right, low address is different, sometimes maybe, and so is this right, the low end of memory, big endian is in logical order how we would read it, versus little endian would be backwards?
So in
this is the low end of memory? So the 255...
Right. Yes. This is a little endian.
Right. Okay, I just want to make sure that was right, because...
Right.
Yeah, cool.
The problem with these little endian things is that suppose you have you don't normally write the thing that comes after this in your struct before it, which is the way you really should if you're saying the low end of memory is here, right? If the low end of memory is here, mm-hmm. and then you write one of these shorts and then another one,
mm-hmm.
You would expect that it's going to go this way. But no, you do the low end of memory for this one, and then you write the next one here with
right.
the low end for that one.
Right.
Right? So yeah. That's what always gets me about little endian.
So I think, I was having, for 360, we were doing some stuff with that was kind of related to that. And
yeah.
It's kind of fun, but...
but it's just error prone. It's the main. It's the kind of thing that you wish somebody else had figured out once and for all, and you didn't ever have to worry about it. Yeah. Which is partly why I like working with languages like Python and Java that do that. Right. In those languages, you basically almost never worry about little endian or big endian
right.
representations. So. Anyway.
All right, we'll see you later.
See you next time. Yeah.